Paper 124, Section 6. The Journey to Jerusalem. Jesus, having now reached the threshold of young manhood, and having been formally graduated from the synagogue schools, was qualified to proceed to Jerusalem with his parents, to participate with them in the celebration of his first Passover. The Passover feast of this year fell on Saturday, April 9, 87. A considerable company, 103, made ready to depart from Nazareth early Monday morning, April 4, for Jerusalem. They journeyed south towards Samaria, but on reaching Jezreel, they turned east, going around Mount Gilboa into the Jordan Valley in order to avoid passing through Samaria. Joseph and his family would have enjoyed going down through Samaria by way of Jacob's Well and Bethel, but since the Jews disliked to deal with the Samaritans, they decided to go with their neighbors by way of the Jordan Valley. The much-dreaded Archelaus had been deposed, and they had little to fear in taking Jesus to Jerusalem. 12 years had passed since the first Herod had sought to destroy the babe of Bethlehem, and no one would now think of associating that affair with this obscure lad of Nazareth. Before reaching the Jezreel junction, and as they journeyed on, very soon, on the left, they passed the ancient village of Shunem, and Jesus heard again about the most beautiful maiden of all Israel, who once lived there, and also about the wonderful works Elisha performed there. In passing by Jezreel, Jesus' parents recounted the doings of Ahab and Jezebel, and the exploits of Jehu. In passing around Mount Gilboa, they talked much about Saul, who took his life on the slopes of this mountain, King David, and the associations of this historic spot. As they rounded the base of Gilboa, the pilgrims could see the Greek city of Scythopolis, on the right. They gazed upon the marble structures from a distance, but went not near the Gentile city, lest they so defile themselves that they could not participate in the forthcoming solemn and sacred ceremonies of the Passover at Jerusalem. Mary could not understand why neither Joseph nor Jesus would speak of Scythopolis. She did not know about their controversy of the previous year, as they had never revealed this episode to her. The road now led immediately down into the tropical Jordan Valley, and soon Jesus was to have exposed to his wondering gaze the crooked and ever-winding Jordan, with its glistening and rippling waters, as it flowed down toward the Dead Sea. They laid aside their outer garments as they journeyed south in this tropical valley, enjoying the luxurious fields of grain and the beautiful oleanders laden with their pink blossoms, while massive snow-capped Mount Hermon stood far to the north, in majesty looking down on the historic valley. A little over 3 hours' travel from opposite Scythopolis they came upon a bubbling spring, and here they camped for the night, out under the starlit heavens. On their second day's journey they passed by where the Jabbok, from the east, flows into the Jordan, and looking east up this river valley, they recounted the days of Gideon, when the Midianites poured into this region, to overrun the land. Toward the end of the second day's journey they camped near the base of the highest mountain overlooking the Jordan Valley, Mount Sartaba, whose summit was occupied by the Alexandrian fortress, where Herod had imprisoned one of his wives, and buried his two strangled sons. The third day they passed by two villages which had been recently built by Herod, and noted their superior architecture, and their beautiful palm gardens. By nightfall they reached Jericho, where they remained until the morrow. That evening Joseph, Mary, and Jesus walked a mile and a half to the site of the ancient Jericho, where Joshua, for whom Jesus was named, had performed his renowned exploits, according to Jewish tradition. By the fourth and last day's journey the road was a continuous procession of pilgrims. They now began to climb the hills leading up to Jerusalem. As they neared the top, they could look across the Jordan, to the mountains beyond and south over the sluggish waters of the Dead Sea. About halfway up to Jerusalem, Jesus gained his first view of the Mount of Olives, the region to be so much a part of his subsequent life. And Joseph pointed out to him that the holy city lay just beyond this ridge, and the lad's heart beat fast with joyous anticipation of soon beholding the city and house of his heavenly Father. On the eastern slopes of Olivet they paused for rest in the borders of a little village called Bethany. The hospitable villagers poured forth to minister to the pilgrims, and it happened that Joseph and his family had stopped near the house of one Simon, who had three children about the same age as Jesus: Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. They invited the Nazareth family in for refreshment, and a lifelong friendship sprang up between the two families. Many times afterward, in his eventful life, Jesus stopped in this home. They pressed on, soon standing on the brink of Olivet, and Jesus saw for the first time, in his memory, the holy city, the pretentious palaces, and the inspiring temple of his Father. At no time in his life did Jesus ever experience such a purely human thrill as that which at this time so completely enthralled him as he stood there on this April afternoon on the Mount of Olives, drinking in his first view of Jerusalem. And in after years, on this same spot he stood and wept over the city which was about to reject another prophet, the last and the greatest of her heavenly teachers. But they hurried on to Jerusalem. It was now Thursday afternoon. On reaching the city, they journeyed past the temple, and never had Jesus beheld such throngs of human beings. He meditated deeply on how these Jews had assembled here from the uttermost parts of the known world. Soon they reached the place prearranged for their accommodation during the Passover week, the large home of a well-to-do relative of Mary's, one who knew something of the early history of both John and Jesus, through Zacharias. The following day, the day of preparation, they made ready for the appropriate celebration of the Passover Sabbath. While all Jerusalem was astir in preparation for the Passover, Joseph found time to take his son around to visit the academy, where it had been arranged for him to resume his education 2 years later, as soon as he reached the required age of 15. Joseph was truly puzzled when he observed how little interest Jesus evinced in all these carefully laid plans. Jesus was profoundly impressed by the temple and all the associated services and other activities. For the first time since he was 4 years old, he was too much preoccupied with his own meditations to ask many questions. He did, however, ask his father several embarrassing questions, as he had on previous occasions, as to why the Heavenly Father required the slaughter of so many innocent and helpless animals. And his father well knew from the expression on the lad's face that his answers and attempts at explanation were unsatisfactory to his deep-thinking and keen-reasoning son. On the day before the Passover Sabbath, flood tides of spiritual illumination swept through the mortal mind of Jesus and filled his human heart to overflowing with affectionate pity for the spiritually blind and morally ignorant multitudes assembled for the celebration of the ancient Passover commemoration. This was one of the most extraordinary days that the Son of God spent in the flesh. And during the night, for the first time in his earth career, there appeared to him an assigned messenger from Salvington, commissioned by Emmanuel, who said, "The hour has come. It is time that you began to be about your Father's business." And so, even ere the heavy responsibilities of the Nazareth family descended upon his youthful shoulders, there now arrived the celestial messenger to remind this lad, not quite 13 years of age, that the hour had come to begin the resumption of the responsibilities of a universe. This was the first act of a long succession of events which finally culminated in the completion of the Son's bestowal on Urantia and the replacing of the government of a universe on his human divine shoulders. As time passed, the mystery of the Incarnation became, to all of us, more and more unfathomable. We could hardly comprehend that this lad of Nazareth was the creator of all Nebadon. Neither do we nowadays understand how the spirit of this same Creator Son and the spirit of his Paradise Father are associated with the souls of mankind. With the passing of time, we could see that his human mind was increasingly discerning that, while he lived his life in the flesh, in spirit on his shoulders rested the responsibility of a universe. Thus ends the career of the Nazareth lad, and begins the narrative of that adolescent youth, the increasingly self-conscious divine human, who now begins the contemplation of his world career, as he strives to integrate his expanding life purpose with the desires of his parents, and his obligations to his family, and the society of his day and age.